Session number 3178, reel number 2. Jeffrey Coffey, reel 2. Was there a good deal of recklessness and misbehaviour in the way people flew?
I think it would be, looking back on it, I suppose you would call it reckless, but it's not reckless at that age. I think it's terribly important to remember that the Royal Air Force could not have done as well in the war if it had not had the sort of accident rate it had in peace. That meant that quite a lot of people did have accidents when they were doing unauthorized low flying, unauthorized aerobatics, or doing aerobatics too low, flying in weather that they should not have flown in, bearing in mind their own inadequacies and those of the instruments they were equipped with. Full stop. You can cut that out, can you? I think it became very clear. I mean, we were allowed on occasion to take our aircraft away for weekend leave with a suitcase in the back. Far more people were killed going on weekend leave than in trying to get back from weekend leave, which is obviously a human approach to life.
Was there quite a high accident rate within your squadron itself?
It was no higher than any other. I would not like to... You would think that 19th Squadron wasn't the best squadron. That the accident rate was high at Duxford with three fighter squadrons. We killed one chap a month with quite a monotonous regularity. And one of my friends actually crashed three aeroplanes in one day, including my own aircraft. We had our own aircraft allocated to us then. There were many reasons for him doing it, but none of them were good ones.
Was it simply carelessness?
Carelessness, I suppose, is the most obvious one. Very few of them were actually technical failure, although, of course, the engines were incredibly unreliable. Of course, about that time, there were a lot of accidents in the Grebes sister ship, the Gamecock, which was a slightly later model, which had a number of cases of aileron flutter and had the wings cut off. That was a serious one and was a technical fault that was put right.
This friend of yours who crashed the three planes, so what were the actual causes of those three accidents?
The first one, he did a very bad landing and ended up on his back. He then borrowed mine and taxied it into another one on the ground. So he only one did he risk injury. But he was fairly unpopular with the squadron commander, and he was grounded for a long while.
Had he been drinking?
No, not drinking at all. No. There was this old tradition that if you had an accident, it was terribly important to fly as quickly as possible after as before you lost your nerve. That was far more a superstition, I think, than a psychological certainty.
Were there inquiries after every accident, or only if someone was actually killed?
There were normally only inquiries into an official court of inquiry, only into a fatal accident, or one involving considerable expense, like flying to a church or something like that, or public interest.
Was there, in fact, a lot of effort to stamp out reckless flying because of the reputation of the RAF?
Oh, there was a tremendous effort by everybody, propaganda and so on, but then wisely handled by the squadron commanders, who could see that too tight a rein would produce bad results in air firing and in everything else.
Were there court-martials for misconduct?
There were court-martials for low flying. There were court-martials, of course. The biggest offence was to write a dud cheque for your mess bill. That was automatic court-martial and cashiering if found guilty. Which gives you quite a healthy respect for your bank statement.
in general, was there any financial misconduct by RAF officers that you came across?
In that period, we're talking about my first 3 years, not generally. People were always incredibly hung up. But people also had far more to do in the mess, in making their own amusements. We would walk to the local pub to have eggs and bacon, because we weren't highly paid and we didn't want big pay.
Apart from bridge in the mess, what sort of other sort of amusements?
Billiards and snooker, and of course squash, apart from the organised games that need teams.
Was there ever any rowdy behaviour on guest nights in the mess?
A guest night was a very wild affair, to the extent that there were certain tests that new officers had to do, which would quite often result in broken limbs. As far as I know, we never killed anybody.
These were sort of initiation ceremonies?
Yes. But some of them were routine affairs. One of them, an initiation, was you had to go around the anteroom in the mess without touching the ground. And you were beaten by all the other chaps if you didn't do it.
Were there any other games that were played?
There were a large number of mess games, and I can't remember what they were all called. Most of them were rather tough games, and very few of them needed much skill. But very few resulted in permanent injury.
Can you describe any of them, even if you can't think of the actual names that they were called by?
I can remember one where you had sides, you divided yourself into sides, probably squadron sides, and your team, the captain put his back to the wall, and you put one chap put his head between his legs and so on, forming a long line, and you tried to see how far you could jump up that line before it collapsed. The other squadron did that, and if you collapsed, if he'd got 10 men on by the time you collapsed, that he'd got 10, and if you only got 9, he won. Now that occasionally resulted in knees being put out or in broken legs.
Would there have been an inquiry?
The squadron commander would be leading the team. And the doctor would be there, as part of the team as well.
You mentioned just now that each pilot had his own aeroplane. Was it customary to decorate or modify your own plane in any respect?
No, you weren't allowed to do that at that stage. But you were, of course, expected to join in with the ground crew in washing your own aeroplane and looking after it and getting to know the ground crew and working with them.
Let's talk a bit now about the kind of training program and exercises that you had to do as a fighter squadron at Duxford. Mm-hmm. First of all, what sort of exercises did you do at Duxford itself?
Having learnt to fly and become a squadron pilot, The aim in the end was to go to the annual camp to do your air firing. Before you did that, you did a large number of camera gun exercises with an opponent, also with a camera gun, and you would do individual combats, and the camera gun film would be assessed. That was the basic aim of the squadron, was, of course, to shoot down an enemy aircraft. Having taken that as the basis, the squadron operated in formation, so the next thing was to learn to fly in formation, and then in formation in cloud, with inadequate instruments, normally a bubble to show whether your wings were level and a compass to see whether you're flying straight. The third one was you did battle climbs, where you got to 15,000 feet, which was about the ceiling of the aircraft, in as quick a time as you could. And that was done very, very regularly in almost any weather. We then also normally took part in the Hendon air display, either as a squadron or as a wing. The Duxford wing and the North Weald wing and the Hawkins wing and so on would all take part. I think it's interesting there to think that you would land the squadron in a formation of nine on the grass field of Hendon, which is certainly nothing like 1,000 yards in diameter. And that was done perfectly easily and regularly without accident. In fairness to the present day people, you must remember that the landing distance was very short and there were no runways, so it was an omnidirectional airfield and you could always land into wind.
What sort of displays did you do at Hendon as the squadron?
All sorts, normally large formations or formation aerobatics in large or small numbers, or mock attacks on bombers, timed so that the attack was seen to take place over the public at Hendon. And that's about all I can remember about what we did.
How did you do these mock attacks on bombers?
Again, normally with information, and you would dive on them, but of course there was no radio, we couldn't talk to each other. Therefore, you could only do it by hand signals with an open cockpit, not with any radio. And you had a camera gun to see if... You wouldn't necessarily have a camera gun at Hendon, because the object there was to display the thing, not to produce a good picture.
Did the bombers have to pretend to be shot down at Hendon when you were doing these interception displays?
They would pretend to be shot down, sometimes with smoke to make it look genuine, and then disappear behind the roofs.
Did you in fact spend a lot of time at Duxford before one of these displays, practicing the things that you were going to do?
Oh yes, because that was what you were being trained to do in real life. So they were very valuable in doing war training.
Tell me then a bit about the kind of things, exercises that you did when you went away from Duxford to the camps.
You know, we always went to the air firing camp at Sutton Bridge near Wisbech, in Norfolk, I think it is, where you were in a tented camp with a tented mess, and the squadrons, I think, spent 2 weeks there while doing real firing with real bullets at targets on the sands of the bay, whatever the bay, the wash, on the sands of the wash. They were individual performances and you were marked on your own results. There were occasional accidents there, as there still are, in attacking a ground target. Some people go too low and concentrate on the target and fly into the target or into the ground, and that is a thing that is bound to happen if that type of training is done, but it wasn't very frequent.
Did you have any near misses from accidents, either at Duxford or when you were away at a practice camp?
I had a near miss in that I had my aeroplane come to pieces and I had to use my parachute. That was while collecting a brand new grebe from the manufacturers. The controls came apart through what turned out to be lack of a split pin in assembly, and I had to bail out and land on the Gog Magog golf course near Cambridge.
Had you been rather doubtful about the value of parachutes? Because they were new things at that point, weren't they?
At about that time, we'd all been given parachutes for the first time, and we tended to regard them as an absolute curse, because you had to carry them out to the aeroplane. They were fairly unwieldy and they were uncomfortable. I think my use of one encouraged the others into taking theirs with them. But of course, most of us had done a practice jump from the wingtip of a bomber to get us accustomed to what it felt like to being in a parachute, and I had done one.
So when you actually had to use it in earnest, you didn't have any particular problems doing that?
No, and you knew what the landing would be like.
I don't think we've talked about which sorts of planes your squadron was actually equipped with. 19 squadron was equipped with it.
We did mention the Gloucester Grebe. And one other squadron there had the Gloucester Grebe, 29 squadron. And 111 squadron had the Armstrong Sidley Siskin. Eventually, we were re-equipped with the Siskin, and then we had three squadrons of Siskins.
What sort of plane was agreed to fly, and how did you find that it compared with the Siskin when you were re-equipped?
None of us liked the Siskin as much as the Grieve when we first got it. It was bigger, it was heavier, and it had a remarkable propensity for turning on its back when you landed it. I didn't do it, but a large number of people in the Royal Air Force ended up with what was known as the Siskin nose, having broken it on the centre section as they turned it over.
Did you feel it had any advantages over the Grieve? It is
not easy to remember why I think it would have any advantage. I think its performance must have been a bit higher, but that's all I can think of.
Was it any more effective for battle climbs?
I can't remember the performance at all, to be quite honest.
Were there any limitations at that time on the amount of training you could do or on the equipment that you had due to shortage of money at all that the RAF was suffering from at that time?
I don't think, as a young officer, one would have been aware of a money reason for not doing anything with your squadron or with your equipment. Personally, of course, it was quite different. There didn't appear to be any restrictions, and if we wanted to fly, we flew, as far as we knew. Whether we were given phony reasons, I do not know.
So there was no limitation on the amount of fuel that you could use? You mentioned earlier that you did no night flying whatsoever at Duxford.
The big difference was that the Siskin did do night flying, and we started night flying when we got the Siskin. Why the Siskin was better for night flying than the Grieve, I don't know.
Did it have the same instrumentation?
Yes.
When you started the night flying, how were the exercises for that?
Well, you only had what they called gooseneck flares, which was a paraffin can with a wick in, on the grass airfield, laid out in the form of a T into wind, and it was not too difficult in good weather, because the thing to do was to flatten out your aircraft when you could identify the flare, as opposed to seeing it merely as a spot of light.
The other thing you mentioned just now was flying in cloud. Did that present a lot of problems given the primitive instrumentation?
It is not easy to know how many people lost control in cloud, but I don't think a lot of people did. Quite a lot of people avoided it whenever they possibly could, like me. But now and again you had to go into it, and there were one or two simple rules you obeyed, like when it began to get on the descent, as it began to get dark, you knew you were getting near the ground. The aircraft was slow by modern standards. It was very, very maneuverable, to the extent that if you came out and saw some trees, you could, normally, unless it was a fog, put on the engine, pull away and miss them.
In general, which was the best of the three squadrons actually stationed at Duxford with regard to all the different aspects of exercising that you had to do?
Well, undoubtedly my own squadron was, as you'd expect me to say, but it was so for one particular reason. We had the best squadron commander, who was the best pilot on the station, and automatically the best leader.
Was the performance of the squadrons monitored at all from outside? You said earlier that you weren't particularly aware that there was such a thing as a group. Were you tested at all by outside?
As far as I know, you see, I never got a chance of being a flight commander. Group headquarters training staff would come round and look at your training charts and see if you've got all the right squares filled up against each pilot. But that didn't come my way, because I hadn't got as far as being a flight commander.
Were you lectured at all while you were there on the actual role of a fighter squadron if war, say, had broken out in 1926? Were there any plans that you knew of for what you would actually do as a squadron?
As far as I know, we were never told there were any plans, and if I think about it now, I can't think what we would have done. We assume, I think, we were defending Great Britain. Against what? I have no idea. And how we would have done it, other than purely visually, with 303 guns, was all that could be done. And where the airfields were suitably placed for that. The only method of knowing they were coming was for somebody on the coast to see them and tell you. So the airfields did not need to be on the coast, they had to be inside. And I think, as customary, the assumption was the target was London.
What was the actual armament of the Grebe and the Siskin?
Two 303 guns, machine guns, firing through the propeller with an interrupter gear.
Did you yourself, when you came to use these guns, did you manage to achieve a reasonable score on them?
Was certainly only average as a shot. One of my friends, one of the three pilots who joined with me, or two who joined with me, was the ace after the squadron commander. He was quite exceptional, and it was very clear that, as with a ball game, there are some people who just are good shots. And he was one of them.
Was the working with a camera gun, in fact, a realistic way of assessing someone's ability? I'm thinking of the fact that you can take a picture when you press the trigger instantaneously, but when you're actually firing at a moving target, would have had to have allowed for the velocity of the other plane.
Yes, I think the number of bullets and the velocity counter each other in the assessment phase. But in fact, you see, it's as if you had a single bullet. And when the camera gun film is assessed, there were means of working out through the angle of the target whether the bullet would have hit it. That needed doing in the office after you got down, and you were marked on that.
Was that a specialist job, assessing the camera gun?
Yeah, but it was done by a chap who'd been trained to do it, but he was also a pilot. I mean, everybody was something as well as being a pilot. You didn't have all the experts modern life is afflicted with at the moment.
Was there any great divide within the squadron between the officers and the airmen when it came to rolling one's sleeves up in the hangars, so to speak?
Oh, none at all. I think one of the tremendous disadvantages now is that the young officer doesn't have anything to do with or command of the men who look after his aircraft and indeed his life, to the extent that I think the centralized maintenance system, which technically is essential, has pushed the need for leadership from young officers away. We commanded our two men who looked after our aeroplane, and they liked us and we liked them. Then that got into the flight and then into the squadron. We were much closer.
Well, you allocated the same two people to do the aeroplane. So you knew who was responsible if there were any.
Oh, yes, and I knew all his family history and so on. And he would come to me if he had a problem, although I was no older than he was.
Was there quite a good deal of, well, what should we say, looking after people on a sort of, I'm not quite paternalistic, but really taking an interest in people's personal problems, actually, within a squadron?
Yes, you didn't get involved in the marital side, because there were so few married people. Some of the NCOs were married, and some of the flight commanders were married, and they were looked after, the airmen's wives. Looking after the other men, it was up to you to know all about your chap and know that he would come to you if he had a problem. And they did.
Was money a big problem for everyone in the RAF?
No, it wasn't anything like the problem it is nowadays, because everybody had much less money, but they were much busier, and they all had an aim in life, and they were happy. I mean, we were all hard up. I mean, £10 in the bank was regarded as a very large sum.
Were there any particular problems that were common amongst any of the, either the officers or the airmen, that you can particularly think of in the way of personal problems?
As far as I know, none. I can't think of any difficulties we had with our men or they with us at all. There was a very clear barrier between officers and other ranks, but it was a friendly one. It wasn't an iron curtain at all.
In general, was Duxford a happy place to do your first period of service in the RAF?
Yes, looking back on it, both, while I was there, we had two station commanders, both of whom were inadequate. I can't say why, really, but they were, and neither of them did go very far in the Royal Air Force.
Did you see very much of the station commander, in fact?
Only when I was under arrest.